This morning's parable of the bridesmaids is a challenging one to preach on, to say the least. There are a number of things that bother me about them, about the parable, but the one that bothered me most is actually similar to the commentary that you'll find in your bulletins by the Bishop of Long Island. It comes down to this. What are we to do with the wise bridesmaids who couldn't spare an ounce of oil? Not the foolish ones, the wise ones. The wise ones who chose their own needs over the needs of others. What are we to do with them? I can't think of any place else in the Bible when we're given such selfish behavior as an example, glorified, you could say. They reply to the not-so-wise ones, no, we cannot share with you because we might not have enough for ourselves. No, we can't share. We're not sure. Just to be safe, we're not sharing because we might not have enough. In a way, both sets of bridesmaids, foolish and wise, it seems, operate from the same premise, a premise of scarcity and a premise of fear. Neither trusts the love of the bridegroom enough, neither trusts that the bridegroom will embrace them, whether they walk in light or darkness, neither trusts to share their abundance with others. And thinking about that, I reflected back over the last few weeks. I thought about what a sharp contrast that is to all that we've talked about during this season of stewardship. I thought about how we've been challenged to be bold in mission, bold in self-giving. We've listened to forum after forum presentation that celebrated the place of mission and outreach here at Emmanuel. Our archives have listed decade after decade of people giving selflessly so that the world might be more and more a place where God's love, God's compassion, God's justice and peace might reign. Yesterday, we buried Ann Bain, who selflessly applied her energies to helping to run our food pantry, to help those who struggle to make ends meet live in dignity. Last week, during the necrology at 8 and 9 o'clock, we remembered so many who have likewise given themselves to the mission and ministry that Emmanuel does in the world. Then I was reminded of something. An article that appeared about 25 years ago in the New York Times. A friend of mine sent it to me, and I had completely forgotten about it. Let me share a bit of what that article said. In 1989, the state of Washington was celebrating the centennial of statehood. 100 years before, Washington had become a state. To commemorate that event, state leaders decided to bury a time capsule. Now, as some of you know, a time capsule is a way of preserving something of ourselves for the future and a way of sending a message from the past to the people of some distant and unknown tomorrow. Unfortunately, in the midst of their preparations, the state discovered a number of things about time capsules that were problematic. They discovered it's difficult to make them last, first of all. Countless capsules had failed and disintegrated. But there was a bigger problem that Washington State faced. Even if the materials inside a time capsule would survive, it's more than likely that no one would actually remember where the capsule itself was located. Washington knew the truth of this because they had buried a time capsule in 1953 to commemorate the territorial centennial, only to discover in 1989 no one could remember where it was buried. And that's not the only case of lost capsules. For according to this article, perhaps the most famous lost capsule of all was from the 1939 World's Fair in New York. It got lost too. And for that fair, the artifacts had been sealed inside a torpedo-like container made of copper, buried, and in order to keep track of it, a book was published and sent to libraries all over the world. But you know what? No one could find the book. Even the Library of Congress didn't have a copy. So it was that Washington State commissioned a communications consultant named Newt Berger to put together a time capsule. Mr. Berger did some extensive research. He talked to scientists, came up with technologies that would survive the centuries, and still there was that problem about remembering where it was buried. What good would it be to have a message if nobody was there to receive it? In the end, Berger made a recommendation to the state, which the state accepted. They decided to do this, create a kind of priesthood, a group of people with special rites and rituals who would pass on what was known from one generation to the next. Capsule children, they initially called them. Today, those 10-year-old children that were chosen are approaching their mid-30s, and I'm sure some of them have children of their own who undoubtedly will pass on the knowledge as well. They and their children and their children's children will play the role of reminding the state of the existence and the location of the capsule and its message. They also decided that once every 25 years, those people would find themselves accompanied by new people, trained as children to keep the memory alive and to insert new information into the capsule. And so they'd invite a new group to join the capsule children. And by doing so, the state hoped to create a continuous narrative from our time all the way to the year 2489, 500 years into the future. The capsule children will pass on a perpetual memory, a living record of the message from the past. Now, so I reread this article this week, and of course I Googled it. And in fact, it turns out that this is the week that the 25 years has passed and come to. Everything's going according to plan. The capsule was placed in a tube, inserted in a steel safe, and as it happens, this coming Tuesday, the 25th anniversary, November 11th, 2014, they're preparing to install that new set of capsule children to join the Enterprise. And of course, they have a Facebook page. It's called Capsule Keepers. What the state of Washington discovered in their quest for an effective time capsule is something the faithful had known about for thousands of years. How does one message get sent into the future? It's not done through books and pens and paper or even computer disks. It's accomplished through the perpetual handing on of living memory, through the constant renewal of our connection with the past, through people touching the lives of those around them in the present, and those then carrying it forward to touch others in the future. Here at Emmanuel, we are following in the steps of those who have encapsulated how to love God, how to care for the poor, how to gently give to others so that they might live lives of dignity, wholeness, justice, and peace. Those who have gone before us are our capsule children, just as we ourselves are now becoming capsule children for those who will follow us. And on this Sunday, when we gather our pledges and carry them up to the altar for 2015, we're creating the base of support so that we can keep embodying keep incarnating, keep encapsulating the love of God in word and deed so that we can continue to be bold in mission. Perhaps the best news of all in this is that the memory we keep alive in this place, in word and in deed, is something greater than the memory of centennial states or governments. The thing we keep alive and pass on is nothing less than the living, vital tradition of God's love for all people. We keep alive the memory and the knowledge and the reality of the incarnation of that love in the person of Jesus. And as such, as a community, we are a time capsule in our attempt to embody that love as a sign for the world. Amen.
Amen.